Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Today on the show, we have the epitome of a power couple, Alex and Leila Harmozi. Together, they have scaled 4 8-figure companies in 3 different industries, including acquisition.com. So without further ado, please welcome Alex and Leila. Hello, everybody. This is Jake Sanzino, host Jake and Gino podcast here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, the chef, the father, six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy. Gino Barbaro. Gino, how's it going?
Mr. Stanziano, I'm doing great today, bro. How you doing? It's only 97 degrees down here. How about up in Knoxville?
It's about the same, man, but we're loving it. We're loving it. So always making it happen. Today, we have a true power couple. We have the CEO and co-CEO of 3 successful companies that have had exponential growth in the last 5 years. The Power Duo manages Gym Launch, a service and coaching program, Prestige Labs, and Allen, a software company that nurtures leads for SMBs. This couple has scaled 3 companies to well over 100 million in cumulative sales across 3 different industries: software, service, e-commerce, and continue to grow. So without further ado, Alex and Leila Harmozi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
So husband, wife here, got to hear the story, how you guys came together, and then ultimately we're able to work together because Gino and I are both married. He does a little bit of stuff with his wife, but ultimately the husband and wife duo can be a touchy one. So love to hear how you guys got together and then how you're able to, you know, keep it going.
I'll give you the very, very, very quick backstory, and then probably the more, you know, we can lead into the more tangible stuff of like, how do you work together without killing each other? You know, because both of us need to be alive in order for us to stay married. It's one of the requisites. So I think the big part of it is that we met almost on business terms. Like, we met for a date and immediately I liked Leila from a business perspective. I offered her a job on the first date and said, even if we don't work out,
how you pull them in, man.
Hey, you know, shooters gotta shoot. So she was a top sales rep for 24 Hour Fitness in Orange County. I owned 5 gyms at the time. And I was like, dude, you know, if you come sell with me, like, we'll make way more money together. And we should also go on another date. And so one thing led to another. I started another business saying, hey, Gym Launch is going to be this cool thing. I want to go do turnarounds. She said, you're crazy. I just met you. I'm not going to quit. Did 3 turnarounds, showed her it worked. And she was like, okay, I'll come on board. So she quit her job, started with me. We did 30 turnarounds plus or minus over the next 2 years. And then in that period, many times almost lost everything, all that good stuff. On the second time I almost lost everything, I told Leila she should break up with me. And it would be the best call for her, you know, me looking out for her. And she said, I would sleep with you under a bridge if it came to that. And that's when I knew I was going to marry her. You know, fast forward, almost lost everything again about 6 months after that. And then we got married 2 months after almost losing everything again, because then everything took off like a rocket. And so that was when we transitioned from me having 6 gyms of my own to selling those to doing the turnaround business. We switched to a licensing business. And that's when everything took off like a rocket. That went up to 4,500 locations. We started a supplement company 2 years later, Prestige Labs, to sell through that distribution base. And then a year after that, we started with Allen, which was a software that worked leads for brick and mortar gym owners originally, but then it scaled out to just all SMBs. We sold majority share of all 3 of those companies in 2021 to APG, sorry, 2 of those to APG, which is a private equity group out of San Francisco. And then we sold Allen to a strategic partner as well in 2021. Now we do acquisition.com, which is our portfolio does about 200 million a year at this point. And so that's what we do. And in terms of how we work together, I will ping pong it to Leila.
I have something to say before we get to this point, though. So I think a very strong power move for guys out there. I met my wife by being her boss. I know Gino did the same thing. For all the dudes out there, get a management position and then you can land your future wife. It's the key to success here, I think, what we're hearing. But we'll hear from you now, Leila.
Yeah. I mean, I think that honestly, the key comes from the backstory, which is like, we started working together before we got married and really before we were dating. And so I think that you know, if the foundation for a couple is that they're married and then 20 years in or 10 years in, they want to start working together, I do think that's actually much more difficult because I've seen it. I've seen people try to make the transition. They're like, Layla, can you help me figure this out for my wife? And I'm like, well, your wife's been a mom and, you know, had her own stuff on the side and been taking care of the house and doing all these other things. And so like, it's asking her to shift identities versus Alex and I met, and my identity was already that of somebody who's like ambitious and wanted a career and wanted to, you know, have a business. And so it's more of like, it was already a match before we got married. And then it just happened that, you know, we started working together and then we were like, oh, well, we work really well together here. We have all these, a shared mission, shared value, shared lifestyle. Like it makes sense that we would get married and we would, you know, have a good life together. And so it was having the foundation of business prior to the foundation of like really a lot of like romantic love based, you know, all that stuff. Like we loved each other, but I'd say like in love, probably not until after we got married. And I think that that's because of just the way that we approached it. And so we always had to work on, you know, how do we create the intimacy outside of the work setting? And that was probably like the first 2 years of our marriage where we focused a lot on. And I would say in the beginning, you know, learning how to communicate inside of work and outside of work, how learning how to balance, I want to say basically having like your husband hat on and then like co-CEO hat on and knowing when you're talking to someone and you're like, which hat is appropriate for that given moment. And so I think a lot of it is being able to switch between those two and then having the proper expectations, right? I think that a lot of like, I want to say like distress in marriages of people who work together comes from the fact that the marriage was based on having a shared, more shared lifestyle together rather than a shared mission or a shared taking on with your spouse. And so sometimes people, when they go into business together, they haven't encountered the kind of situations that they will when they go into business together. And it's very hard, you know, having to make decisions in front of people, having to show up together in front of teams of people and, you know, not be able to not be on the same page. Otherwise you pretty much look like a joke. A lot of like high pressure situations where I think we got lucky in the sense that like we started it with that. And so like the marriage side actually came much more easily because we had to work on the communication with the work side so much that it actually, though it was where we had to focus, it wasn't hard to focus on it because if you can learn to run a company together and, you know, dictate like how you run the teams and do all those things, then it's much easier to figure out how you do things with marriage. Because especially if you look at how people parent and how they run teams, it's actually pretty similar.
I want to stay right here for a second because it's something that we learned in the last couple of years as a couple. And I feel like we're going like into like Dr. Phil stuff here, but this stuff matters, right? It's important. And so I think you proved the business side of it first before the marriage and spousal stuff came after. But is there a cadence to your marriage outside of the business? Because my wife and I really got into a nice routine in the last few years where we're meeting every Sunday, kind of going over, you know, everything that's important to us. And we really covered that from a family perspective, a business perspective, et cetera. So did you carry that cadence of, you know, like scaling a company almost into the relationship side as well?
I don't think so, actually. I think that we tried and it didn't work for us.
Okay.
So I think what we found worked really well for us was, you know, in the beginning, we actually had a lot of people who were like, you need to be doing these things and you need a date night and you need to not talk about work and you do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And having that pressure put on us, that's just not how Alex and I are. That is what is for a lot of people. But for both of us, our whole lives have been super career oriented. And so to say that you can't talk about work when we go on a date makes no sense to us. It's not just work. It's like our life's mission, our life's work. Yeah. It's his heart, right?
And who the hell is he going to talk to? I mean, is at the top of a company is very lonely at times. So at least you two can bounce things off each other. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, we found that just honestly, just the more transparent communication that you can have with your spouse, I think that the less we need rigid routines. And so the more that we've become better at communicating with each other, the less that we've had rules or routines in place for our marriage. And the more that we just kind of go with the flow and make sure like, hey, if I want quality time, I'm communicating. Hey, if I think we should go on a date, I'm communicating. Hey, if, you know, I'm going to ask you to do something, I ask. And so I think that sometimes rules kind of replace communication because it's like, well, now I don't need to ask. It's just going to happen because there's a rule in place or there's a routine in place. And I think that we just try to really focus on the communication so that we can remain flexible in the other areas, because I don't think either of us like having that kind of structure.
Alex, you said top of the show, I almost lost everything flippantly 3 or 4 times. What'd you do? What mistakes did you make to lose everything almost 3 or 4 times?
Let's see. The first time lost everything was when I sold all the gyms, put all the money into a new business with a partner that had been indicted for fraud previously that I was aware of. He said it was a miscommunication, misunderstanding. I believed him. And we ended up, you know, he took out what he believed was his share of the profit of the business, which was everything in the bank account, which was all the money that I had put into it. And said, well, I know you're, he said, he accused me of taking money out of the bank account, which I was like, just where, you know? And when he didn't want to look at the financials, that's when I knew, like, that was, he didn't actually think that. So, that was the first time I lost everything. Second time was shortly thereafter. Layla had done a Hail Mary and, closed $100,000 in cash up front in like the first month of doing this new model, which pretty much covered all my losses and debts on basically all the aftermath of that thing. Because there were still fees that were coming out for all these businesses, but I didn't have cash to cover them and I couldn't sell to keep them going because then I would have had to continue to fill contracts in a business that I didn't want to be a part of anymore. So that money that she made basically covered all the losses there. And then we did another $100,000 because we did about $100,000 every time we did a launch for a gym turnaround. And I had about $23,000 total saved up after all of this stuff and shenanigans, which is for me, it was not a lot going from having working capital for 6 locations and all that kind of stuff. And then the money from the sales never came in because the processor saw that there was irregular activity in the account because we were selling contracts all over the nation out of a brick and mortar processor, which I didn't know that you couldn't do that, but that is, you're not supposed to do that. So then they held on to the $100,000 and I had to pay the sales guy his commissions on money I never got. And I never ever did get it actually. So I paid him $22,000 in commissions on 23. So I had $23,000 in total. So I had $1,000 left.
How old were you when all this is happening, by the way?
I was 27, I think.
So it's a lot for like a 27-year-old to be taking and learning too.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, so I had $1,000 left. And then that's when I told her she should leave me because we're going to do this kind of, I was going to say, hey, you know, if one gym a month doing $100,000, was a good idea, let's do 6 next month. Cause that was, you know, my brilliant idea. And so that was going to cost $3,300 a day, which I figured the $100,000 that I was going to get from that last launch would fund this next one for the first month. But then I didn't get the $100,000. So she got 6 of her friends to quit all their jobs and start, 2 days after I found out I was not going to get the money, which happened to be Christmas Eve. When I found out, also when I met her father for the first time, right after I got my DUI. So I was,
we're stacking the pain here.
Yeah. And I was sleeping in her parents' guest bedroom as a winner from the internet. And so,
ouch.
Yeah. And so we were going to put $3,300 a day on a credit card that I had. That was my business account credit card that Amex for some reason had not canceled yet. So I had $100,000 limit and I put $100,000 in the first 30 days on the card. And that's when I was like, you should probably leave. This is probably not going to be pretty. But we ended up making exactly $100,000 the first month. And that covered, you know, that got me out of that one. And then the next, you know, crash and burn was, all of a sudden all those gyms that we were doing those 6 launches a month with, some of the gyms, because we were not interfacing with the owners, decided it would make more financial sense for them to, tell all the customers that we had signed up at their facilities to refund and sign up through them. So that they could collect the cash.
Wow.
Which obviously did not work for the model that we had, which was if we don't make money, you know, and you refund all the sales that we paid all the money to acquire and paid the sales guys and commissions and hotels, does a good business not maketh? And so we lost everything again there. That was the second time or third time. I don't know if we're keeping track. Third time maybe that I'd pretty much gone down to zero again.
Sound like Ray Kroc right now almost, like in the struggles that he went through in McDonald's. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, to be honest with you, like I was just very numb at the time. And I just kind of expected everything to be fucking on fire all the time. And so I didn't even know what it looked like when it was right. I was like, of course it didn't work. Like nothing fucking works, you know? And so, that was when we actually, for a brief period, started selling weight loss because Layla had a side hustle of doing like online weight loss coaching and it was working pretty well. And so we started doing $1,000 a day selling weight loss programs online. I was like, hey, this could work. Let's get 8 sales guys in. We could take them from the, you know, from being outbound in the field to just like selling from home. Make $8,000 a day, and that could cover the $150,000 in losses that we had this month, and then we could be scot free.
Someone's on that hamster wheel. You're keeping going on that hamster wheel. And when did you, Layla? 2 questions. First of all, Layla, why did you stay with him? Honestly, I mean that's a big commitment. I know till death do us part, but that's a tough one. Having that roller coaster. I mean,
we were just dating. We weren't even married.
Ah, wow. So what did you see in Alex that made you want to stay with him?
You know, I think from the moment I met Alex, I thought that he was really bright and really interesting. And like, we had a ton in common, so we got along really well. But I think more than anything, I also saw that, and no offense to all the people that Alex was working with, but I saw somebody who had like a really great vision, a ton of energy, a ton that he wanted to pour into the world. And I didn't feel like he had a ton of great support around him to help him do that. And I think like, I've always traditionally, like in most of the jobs I've been in, been like kind of like the number 2 to somebody. And so when I saw that with Alex, I was like, he just like doesn't have people around to help him do all this other stuff, you know, or to like kind of help guide him or like looking out for his best interest, because most people are looking out for their own best interest and kind of disregarding him. And I think he's such a giver that I think that people take advantage of that, right? And especially when you're younger and you don't know and you don't have experience and stuff. And so I think I just wanted to help bring his vision to life, and I believed in him. And I saw everything that was going through, but like I'm a reasonable enough person. I was like looking at the evidence in his life and, you know, where he was at. And like, despite all of this, like Alex was still successful at a young age. Right. Mm-hmm. If you talk to him, you'd be like, this guy is really bright. And so I think it was that combined with what we had already been through together. I was like, I don't have a doubt in my mind that this is just like a rough patch. Like, this is just a season. You're not like some, you know, like
he's going to figure this out.
Dead end. Yeah. I was like, you'll figure this stuff out. Like, it's just going through a rough time. And
what about the
as,
parents, though? Were your parents like putting pressure on you and like, you know, this is now they're cool. They're good.
No, yeah. My parents don't give a shit. okay. You know, they're like, you're young. I mean, they say the same thing. Like, you're young. Figure it out. Yeah. And I think
that it was 23 then.
Wow. So,
yeah. So, you know, I think that sometimes you just know. And I remember saying to Alex, I was like, I just know that once we get past this rough patch and like these stressful moments and times, like, one, we're choosing this because we're trying to do something that most people aren't doing. So it's a choice. If we want to just sit by and live passive lives, then we probably wouldn't have a lot of the stuff going on, especially you, but you're trying to make a big change. And so there's a lot of, you know, resistance. And then, you know, second to that is just like, I did have like an unwavering belief in him. I think that was probably also like almost like a placebo I put on him so that I could feel good about what we were doing and more secure. And so I think I just had so much unwavering belief in him that it was like, I was like, he's like, you know, he really thought in that moment, he's like, this is going to fail. And I was like, no, it's not. Like, we're going to figure it out. Like, I just know that he could figure it out on his own, and like us together absolutely could figure it out.
Mm-hmm. So Alex, you're a 3-time loser right now.
Many times more than that. There's just big highlights.
But what you said, it all of a sudden it clicked and it just everything blew up. What clicked in your life and what clicked in the business specifically? Because I'm going to get into the book. I got a hold of the book, the $100 million offer. It's a friggin' amazing book. I've got so many quotes and I want to go through with it. But that whole I love that Russell Brunson talks about that story from where you were to where you came. I mean, what was that defining moment for yourself?
So I would say, you know, if we were to reverse this and say, like, what were the things, like, you, to allude to the question you asked earlier, which is what are the mistakes that you made, right? So like, what are the principles that I was not adhering to? So I had bad partnerships. That was number one. And I had many of them. So it wasn't like I said one. Like when Layla met me, I think I had like 5 partners in different businesses. Number one. Number two, I was not focused. So I didn't focus on one opportunity. I was chasing every single shiny object I possibly could at the same time and working myself. I literally think when we met, I had 8 businesses. 8. And I was not making, I mean, I was making revenue, but I was making no take home because I was spreading myself way too thin. So that's like principle number two. Principle number three is that the business models that I had did not adhere to common sense or human incentive. It didn't make sense for a gym, you know, a small business owner, the moral risk, it was too easy for somebody to just tell their clients, hey, the guy's gone, he paid all the money, and I have no risk to just tell these people, like I have a moral risk, but like, a lot of times that's, you know, when you got a guy who on average makes $30,000 a year or maybe less, because some of these guys are losing money, when you've got $100,000 sitting right in front of you from some dude, some kid in the internet who showed up at your doorstep, you never met, and 30 days later, he's gone. $100,000 and you don't even have to see him again. All you do is you just tell these people, hey, just sign up for me. It's hard to say no to that. You know, I would never do that, but like some people would. And so enough people did that it didn't work. So the human incentives were misaligned. And then number four was, the opportunity vehicles that I was using in the earlier part of my career were low leverage. So the input to output, the discrepancy between the inputs I would put in and the outputs I would get were low. Whereas what we switched to, which was a licensing model, we had built in leverage. And so the input to output ratio was significantly higher. So for example, if I take time to build a licensing model, I have that input one time and then I can sell that 100 times and there's no real added input after that, after the first initial investment. Whereas the other businesses I had were ongoing input to get output. So sales models, we had to go and we had to sell stuff to make money. With the gym model, when I was there, it's like we had to fulfill personal training packages. We had to fulfill gym memberships. We had to do the stuff to make the money. Whereas here we did the stuff once and we could sell it unlimited amount of times. And so that was where we actually used the first real leverage, which was media, that we were to leverage there. And so that was kind of probably like principle four. And then principle five was providing the most value I possibly can. I literally just got off the phone with a company that we were looking about investing in just, I mean, like an hour ago. And they have a, you know, they have a good business. They're probably doing $400,000 a month. And we told the founder, we're like, you know, we really like you and your co-founder, and we don't like your business. I think you have more value than you are providing. He has this really amazing marketing and sales skill set, and he's trying to shove it through this model that he has known for years, but like, he's not that good at it.
He needs a better vehicle
in sales.
Yeah.
I was like, dude, we should put, let's think about the big universe of things you could provide to people. And then let's try and provide the thing that has the most value, and let's make that the business. And so I basically had to tell him to like, I think you should kill this business, even though it's, you know, making money and it's profitable, because I think you have a $50 million business inside of you, and you're stuck in a $4 million opportunity. And so, you know, he took that and was like, wow, I have to, you know, chew on this. And I was like, you know, you could redline this to $1 million a month, but it's going to cap.
Wow. And how did he take that?
He took it really well, honestly, alormingly well. He was like, I've been thinking about this, blah, blah. So it actually worked out really well. But a lot of people are not that receptive. But I think he's a winner. I think he can go to 50.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how you enhance an offer. Cause in the book you talk about enhancing the offer. So you talk about that with the business. Can you go into that real quick with us?
Yeah, sure. I mean, fundamentally the offer is just the discrepancy between how much it costs you to fulfill something and how much value it provides to the person you're selling it to. Right. And so ideally we want to find the things that are worth a ton of money to people that don't cost us a lot of money to fulfill on. Like that's the nature of capitalism. And they're like, what's interesting is that there are a lot of businesses out there, and most businesses are not good. Like most businesses are not worth being in, but that's okay. Someone will be in it. It doesn't have to be you. Like manufacturing, tough business. Not to say that someone won't do it, because the thing is like based on the marketplace, like as more people fall out of manufacturing, the interest in manufacturing might go up because demand might go up and there might be an opportunity, but then it'll rapidly disappear and then margins will compress. And so we try and find opportunities that have high leverage in kind of embedded within them, which is why we tend to focus on tech-enabled or media-enabled services or education businesses, because there's usually an inherent amount of leverage, you know, build once, sell twice. That are kind of sewn into that model.
Mm-hmm. Can I share with you what happened with me a few years ago? I had a restaurant, I had one location, and I think most small businesses fall into this trap. They start a business for the wrong reason. It sounds like you guys just want to provide massive value. Most business owners, myself included, want to start a business to provide for their family. They don't think about their end user. They don't think about their customer. So they're only worried about how much money they're making for themselves. And they don't grow because they're only worried about themselves. They have the scarcity mindset. They don't think about providing value and starting the business model from that. So that's what I realized. And, you know, within 5 years, Jake and I have 2,000 apartment units. What happened? I just figured about, okay, how do we provide value for residents? How do we provide value for investors? And that sounds really simple and really stupid.
It's a better business though, too.
Yeah,
like,
but it
like
sounds
to his point, Gina. Like, if you're in a better vehicle, you don't got to be the best entrepreneur. Sometimes the vehicle can carry you. I'm not saying we suck, but it's like we're in a much better vehicle than in a restaurant. That's for damn sure.
But I could have franchised the business. I could have thought of other things. I could have done products. I could have done the whole thing. I just didn't think of the business as just only providing for my family, not as the end user, not as the customer. So I think that was for me was a huge paradigm shift for me. In the book, I love what you say in the book. Passive income is overrated. We seek freedom, but what we really seek is options for engaging activity. You got a little fat when you got rich and wealthy. You were hanging out and eating every day. And what did that do to you? I mean, like you probably lost your way. You're probably sitting, I'm getting home, I'm getting bored. How was that feeling? I mean, that really hits home, because we all want financial freedom, but most people don't understand what financial freedom is. I became financially free. I started working more because I love what I'm doing right now. So I think for you, it's probably the same thing.
Yeah, we just want options. I think, and the thing is if you own lots of assets, I mean, and this, you know, I will say this, a lot of times, you know, it's the wand chooses the wizard, you know, to quote Harry Potter.
Say that again.
The wand chooses the wizard, you know.
Oh, the so wand. I got you.
Yeah. The vehicle, a lot of times, this is, you know, getting a little meta, but like, I think that if you meet people, you can usually like real estate guys are, there's like a flavor, you know what I mean? Like there's a different vibe that's like in the real estate. And you guys know the difference between,
yeah, it's residential posture
guys, right?
Even residential
commercial guys, right? Mm-hmm. Or even like wholesalers, different speed, right? Yeah. Different type of guy. And so, I think a lot of times we have to find the vehicle that matches our internal cadence. Like for me, real estate, a little slow, from a, like just big multi, great wealth preservation, all the tax stuff, get it. It's just like, I like business more. Like I want, like you can't, it's uncommon to 10x the value of an apartment building in 12 months. Like, I mean, that's a minority of circumstances, but can we do it in a business? Every fucking day, all the time. right? And like that to me is really, really cool and very interesting. And so I tend to be on that speed, you know, like, and the thing is there are tons of multi-billionaires in real estate, and there's multi-billionaires in business and tech. Like, I'm not necessarily a tech guy. That's even faster. I don't know. That's, I don't know if that's my speed. You know what I mean? And so I think it's really making sure that we pick the right, we let the right boat pick us.
So Layla, how do you keep him down the fairway? Because it seems like he's got the shiny object syndrome every day and he's chasing after businesses. How do you choose the right business? Because there's so many opportunities out there, especially since with acquisition.com and scaling up and looking at all these different opportunities. How do you choose the right opportunity?
I think that we look at it much more from the people point of view rather than the business point of view, because, you know, in terms of investing in the businesses, you know, you can change the business, you can change the business strategy, you can change the product it sells, how it markets, how it sells in general, the market it even sells to, the customer, but it's really, you can't change the founder that you partner with. And so I think that we actually put the person first in saying, like, are we partnering with the right kind of person? You know, do they align with our core values? Are they competitively great, right? And I think that a lot of people, like, we see so many good businesses that I'm like, this business is fucking awesome. But like the person, you know, you're like, what's your goal? And they're like, I mean, if I could make 10 million bucks off this business, I'd be stoked. And I'm like, dude, what are we gonna do once we hit 10 million? Because some people just don't have that drive. And so we're really looking for people who have that drive. And they're like, if somebody gets the phone, they're like, I want to take this, like, I really realistic. They're like, this could go to 100 million or half a billion. We're like, those are the kind of people we want to partner with. And so I think it's mostly evaluating the founders that we're partnering with. And then also even evaluating, like, if they're not that person that could take it to 50 or 100 million, do they at least have enough humility so that when we get to that point, they would step down and let someone else step in? And so it's kind of playing out all those scenarios before we decide if we're going to invest in a business. And most of the time, it's saying no to businesses that are great just because we don't think it's the right person running them. And, you know, Alex and I were talking about this in the car the other day. We were literally like, gosh, there's so many like sick businesses and the people running them, just like they're running them into the ground. They're not leaders. So like nobody wants to work for them. You know, they're doing something unethical. I mean, like there's so many businesses.
Distracted.
The strategy in general is so good, but like they just aren't, they're not playing the game to optimize to win the game of business. They're probably playing a different game and they don't know what that game is, but it's one that's not going to help them win in business. And so we see that a lot and it's unfortunate, but it's just true.
You just described every mom and pop apartment owner that we've bought in from. Literally to a T. And it's exactly, we like literally target that. And we wrote a book on it. It's exactly what we look for. So it's just disengage. Don't treat it like a business. You know, they thought apartment investing was great. So they plopped some money into it and then they let it go to shit. It's a death spiral. So
yeah. Before we go to the short answers, you've said in the book, I love it. Money is a denomination of time. Just go into that real quick for me and let people understand what that means. Because at a certain point, you've had enough money. You can buy anything you want. I mean, money's not really the ultimate thing, I would say.
Yeah. Well, you know, the reason that I'm not a believer in like passive or active income, so we can tie both those short things together, is because we are alive and we spend seconds, literally every second we are alive, and we receive money during that same period of time. So everything can be broken down to dollars per hour. Now you can get more or less, so you can have more passive or less or more active, you know, so it exists on a continuum rather than a binary. Is this passive? Is this not passive, but rather how passive is it? And so time is the denomination of money because it is the one thing that everybody trades in order to get money. So everyone at some basic level trades time to get money, and then they trade less time and less time and less time, ideally, for more and more and more money as they increase in leverage. And so leverage being the discrepancy between inputs and outputs in a system, if we can get lots of leverage in the opportunity, then it means that we trade our time for lots and lots of money. And so ideally, that's what we want to do, is trade very little amount of time for lots and lots of money. And so at the foundational unit, though, money becomes a placeholder for time. And so if I buy a Lamborghini and it costs me 2 days income, and somebody else wants to buy a Lamborghini and they're making the median income in the United States for a family of 50, you know, 50 grand, it's going to cost them 10 years of earnings pre-tax, you know, versus, you know, 2 days of earnings. And so it cost us less time, even though the money was the same. So it is a placeholder for time.
All right. Very good. All right, gang, let's take a quick time out to our sponsor.
Involved in multifamily, this is where you need to be.
The team you've built,
is incredible.
There is no egos here. Everyone is always looking to help the other person.
All right, we're back. We're going to get into a little bit of the economy right now. I went on the Google this morning, and it has stagflation as persistent high inflation combined with high unemployment and stagnant demand in a country's economy. We got Dalio talking about this, saying it's coming. I'm not sure we're there yet. I think there's still demand. I think it's market specific. I think it could be waning, especially in real estate. And there could be cracks. Like, I'm actually excited because I hope it opens up some talent opportunities for employees and team members to join. But love to hear your take on this and how it could potentially impact your business.
We are not financial specialists, so I'll give you the shooting from the hip, which is that we have.
Dude, we're always shooting from the hip, man. Come on.
So, you know, Ray, I mean, if you want, like Ray Dalio specifically was talking about this in 2013. So this is not like a new, you know, it's been a decade that he's been saying that the world's going to fall apart. And, you know, the thing is, if you bet,
I do love his content though, man. He's a smart dude.
Oh yeah. Super smart. Yeah. And if you bet that the world's going to fall apart, there's going to be a recession. You bet over a long enough period of time. You're right. Sure.
15 years, you're going to hit at least once, right?
Yeah. Right. And so, you know, that's my big Himalayan, you know, grain of salt. You know, Warren Buffett bought his first stocks, right after Pearl Harbor got hit. I think that was probably a harder time in the United States than today is. And so he bought stocks because he said, and that was when we weren't even sure if America was going to win the war, because he said, no matter what, people are going to need to buy goods and services. And so I think that's, you know, from a big picture perspective, I don't think the people of America are going anywhere. People will need to buy goods and services, and they will prefer to buy them from places that provide value in excess of the dollars that they're spending. And so big picture, if you provide value, you know, skills, high value skills are inflation proof, whether you're trading in Bitcoin or shekels or IOUs or dollars, you know, it doesn't really matter. And so the big three that we talk about in terms of a stagflation or inflationary environment is, one, increasing your earning capacity, because that way doesn't matter what it's being denominated in, you'll make more.
Number two
is that you're in a business or an opportunity that does not require a lot of capital expense. So it doesn't require, like, you're not in manufacturing as an example, or e-commerce. Both those types of industries, I think, will take a hit in an inflationary environment, because it just takes more capital to grow those businesses. So they get less incremental return per unit of capital that they put out versus a capital light business, which is, again, you know, for us, why we invest in services and e-learning businesses and education businesses, because they are media, which tends to be capital light in terms of expanding them. And so those are kind of the things that we focus on. So high cash flow being the third piece, which is kind of more of a symptom or byproduct of the first two.
Now, I don't know, maybe manufacturing, like COVID exposed it as the U.S. is weak, right? We need to bring some things maybe back in-house, even though it's a pain in the ass. We'll see where it goes. Talking about scaling, you guys obviously had some shitty team members early on, shitty partners, it sounds like. And I think scaling gets easier with time if you focus on it, but also building the team around you. Obviously have scaled quite a bit. Any tips for listeners, people that are early on in their entrepreneurial venture that you want to share?
I mean, I think Layla and I had the partners and team that we deserved at the time. You know what I mean?
Based on experience,
it was 100% our fault. Like, we didn't have the hardest thing is having the perspective from which to make a judgment, which is why I think mentors and advisors and things like that are so helpful. Because, like, if you've never built a $30 million company, you don't know what the finance function needs to look like at 30 million. You might know what it looks like at 10, or might know what it looks like at 3, but what does the function look like? And what does the talent look like to create that function at that scale? And so, you know, for us, Layla and I, you know, we had to fail our way to get there, which is like, oh, that's not what that person looks like. Oh, that's not what that person looks like. And we just had to, you know, learn through fire. You know, in the second and third and fourth, you know, fifth businesses that we've, you know, scaled past 1 million, 2 million, et cetera, a month, we make fewer mistakes along the path because we know what it looks like when it's right. And so it's much easier. I'm sure you guys, when you're, you know, buying your first apartment building compared to buying your 20th apartment building, it feels easy.
The team looks so much different too, man. Like we had some rough folks early on, and it's mentally like, that's all we can get. Like you're small, you're starting out, and it's a lot of reps. And the people that are, some of the folks, unfortunately, that are with us today may not be there in 3 to 5 years as the company continues to grow. It's just
that's okay.
Hard facts. Yeah.
Yeah. That's okay. And they're going to be on the, you know, they'll be a free agent and they'll be recruited to a team that better uses their stuff. I mean, that's the economy. It's going to be, people get reshuffled around to maximize productivity. Like that's okay. You know, that's fine.
Yeah. You know, it's, you kind of touched on a minute ago, like your appetite, where you land in the real estate game. So much of our business is a base is based around, like, we think in decades, 10-year planning. You know, the rates are based on 10-year treasury. We get 10-year money typically, and we underwrite for the long term. You know, I saw some of your content around brand, and I think it was really good. And I think it may align with this, but just love to hear, you know, your perspective on long-termism and, you know, planning for the long term.
I mean, I think the single greatest competitive advantage in anything you do in life is having a long-term perspective. And the thing is it's really hard to do. But I think if you
ask, why is that though?
Because people, I mean, why do people not have six packs? Because they're not long-term thinking. Like, they can't give up the cookie to have the six pack, like at a fundamental level. And so I think that gets expressed in all aspects of people's lives. Like, they have, you know, they want to cheat rather than staying with their wife. They want, even though it's a local benefit for a global cost, rather than having a global benefit for a local cost. So they take the, they can't do the cost short term. They're not willing to put up with the discomfort of something that's harder in the short term. Like branding, for example, you have to forego the right hook early of making the ask to your audience and asking them for money and doing whatnot, rather than building the brand and building it around value and building around giving. And brands, at least in my perspective, is built around making promises and fulfilling promises over and over and over again. And ideally fulfilling more than you promised. And so if the reputation that we have, what people say about us behind our back, is our brand, then it starts with, you know, the content we make. And that's what eventually builds the brand. Because people are like, what is branding? Branding is just your reputation. And how do you build a reputation? You make promises and you keep promises and you do it for a very long period of time. And that's fundamentally it. And what's interesting is that within a business, brand has very, very real value. Because if you think about the difference between, you know, if this was a Louis Vuitton tank top versus a, you know, whatever, Amazon Essentials tank top, it could more or less be the same material, you know, maybe marginally different, but one's going to sell for $100 and the other one's going to sell for $1. And so you think about the pricing power of 100x for just simply for stitching on a logo, like that's the power of brand. And brand takes time to build. But once you do realize the brand, it allows you to price above market and sustain that. And so in a very real way, branding gives you pricing inelasticity. So you can continue to increase your prices and your demand will not change very much. And so that is the goal. And then pricing being the strongest lever for profits, if you can double your prices and lose 10% of your customers, that's a great brand. And so that is how you can measure the strength of the brand, is how price inelastic are my products and services based on the branding that I have. And so for us, we see branding as probably, you know, I've changed a lot in 6 years. If you were to listen to some of my earlier content, I was like, fuck brands, like run ads, look at LTV to CAC ratio, jam it. That's it. That's all I cared about. And that is a way to make money. But if you want to build wealth and build an asset, the brand becomes a big part of the asset. And that's what builds the enterprise value itself, rather than really being just what I would consider an arbitrage opportunity, where you have media at $1 and some sort of conversion mechanism at $3. And you just try and jam as many dollars through that machine as you possibly can. That's arbitrage.
When did you have that epiphany though, of that change? Because that's really hard for us. We have an education company, Jake and Gino, same thing. You want to get leads, you want to get mentorships, and people are foregoing the podcast that we have, the books that we're writing. That's really long-termism. And when did you have that? Because you only said 6 short years ago, you're just trying to make money. Let's jam, ram and jam. When did that
change? And that mental evolution, because I think Gino and I have been going through it for the last 2 years, but probably haven't pushed nearly as hard as you. So what was that mental evolution like as you're going through that?
The beginning of the crack in the armor was when Kylie Jenner became a billionaire. Like, dead serious. Like, when she became a billionaire at age 20, I was like depressed for like a day or two.
Like, what the fuck am I doing? Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, 100%. Like, people be like, I always tell this story and people like laugh, but I really like looked at myself in the mirror and I was like, why do you suck so much? Like, why are you like, how, she is 6 years younger than you and she's a billionaire and you are so far away from being a billionaire. Like, she must be doing something better or different than you are. Like, that was like, so one fundamental belief at my core that I believe is that if someone is making more money than me, they are better at the game in some way than I am. In that way, I can learn of them. And so like, if there's one belief that anyone who's listening can take, is like, if someone's making more money than you, rather than saying like, fuck them, they're doing something, you know, I don't like their blah, 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 blah. It's just like, they're better than me at something. And I just have to figure out what it is. And so she became a billionaire. Then Conor McGregor launched Proper 12, and that was worth $600 million. The Rock came out with Terramana. That's worth between $2 and $4 billion. Huda Beauty, hers is now worth over $1 billion. And I just saw again and again and again. And I was like, fuck this. Like, what do
There's
they have?
There's nothing special about The Rock's tequila besides The Rock's backing it. Yeah.
Brand. Yeah, and so that was my big epiphany, where I was like, that's it. I kept poo-pooing this brand idea. you know, and then Gary V launches an NFT and makes $100 million, you know what I mean? Like in the first like 6 months.
No shit. I didn't even know that.
Yeah. And he's making 40 or 50 million a year in income from the NFT, just from the trading volume in income. And so and with, I mean, not that there's no operational infrastructure behind it, but I would say it's very light compared to a business that does 50 million in EBITDA.
Dude, way easier, right? Well, not easier to achieve, but you're not fucking laying bricks, right? So
I mean, he's not selling, you know, for him to hit 50 million in EBITDA in his agency business, I don't even know if VaynerX hits 50 million in EBITDA compared to him making 50 million in income from the NFT. So all of these were just cracks to this armor that I had around branding not mattering and being like, here's fucking evidence limiting that you're wrong. Too.
Yeah.
Here's evidence you're wrong, Alex. Look at it. And so, you know, I had to confront that and be like, yeah, I'm just wrong. The difference is, and this is the big realization that I had, is that branding could create significantly higher ROAS than direct response marketing, comma, over a long enough time horizon. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, is that direct response marketers will always say, you can't do branding because the return on ad spend is so low. And the question is, what time horizon are we measuring over? So I promise you, if I spent $10 million on just impressions on building a brand and the message, let's assume the message mattered and it resonated with a certain audience, et cetera. If I did that and built an audience spending $10 million, I guarantee you that after I had done that, I could turn it into something that was worth 50 or 100 overnight. And then I would still have the brand equity provided I made promises and over-delivered on the promises that I made. Right. And I think that's the, like, most people can't wait a year. Like you really can build a brand in 12 months if you just try and give without taking from the audience. You just give. Most people don't give with, they've got a gun behind their back and they're like, yeah, here
you go, like, you know, run to the back of the room.
Yeah. And they just want to club, you know, they want to club them over the head as soon as they come over to them. So it's like, if you just give, people come, they'll nibble. And then they're like, huh. They're waiting for the other shoe to drop. And then when it never drops, they shift. And then they're like, this guy's for real. He really just wants to help. And then they tell everyone. And then that's when you get kind of the viral effects around a brand. At least that's Alex's 2 cents in 2022.
So your 2 cents on the thing that will move brand the most is to continue to give without asking in return. Is that 100%. Fair to say?
100%. Yeah. It's giving far more than you ask, I would say, and doing it consistently for a long. So I know I was going to do some research on this, but like, if you look at how people allocate attention, right? So like every second of every day, we're allocating our ears, we're allocating our eyes, we're giving attention to things, right? And then as technology's advanced, more and more parts of that attention are getting monetized, right? Like we've got these ads that come on here on podcasts, we've got ads everywhere, right? And so if we think about what are the things that we pay our attention to, they are things that give us value. And so there's a ratio that all the tech companies have already studied, which is what amount of giving must people get per, because like you can't run ads for this whole podcast because then no one would listen to it, right? So there is a ratio where people are willing to give versus get, and striking that balance. And the more you err towards the give rather than the take, the faster the brand grows. The more you go towards take, like, and there's the balance point where you're at break even. And that's where a lot of people, at least the good business people, are here. And then the terrible business people are just at take and they can never grow because they always immediately, as soon as they get a drop of demand, they immediately try and monetize it rather than letting that drop turn into a bucket.
The commission breath.
Was that? Commission breath.
I said the commission breath. Yeah, 100%.
So Layla, how do you build a brand? I mean, you guys are all talking about brand. I mean, what would you do, Layla, to build that brand and to continue to grow it?
I don't really think I have much else rather than Alex to say. It's not really my focus, honestly. I mean, I think I focus more on doing the thing. And then like, when I think of brand, I think it's just like letting the external see what the internal is. Mm-hmm. That's how I see it. Is I think the strongest brands are just people who are true to themselves and they're just showing the world what they're already doing. Rather than, I think a lot of people say, like, how do I build a big brand? And it's like, well, if you're not doing anything cool or interesting, then it's going to be hard to build a big brand. I think, you know, someone asked me that, they're like, how do you build a viral brand? I definitely don't have a viral brand at all. So I was like, I don't know why you're asking me, but I would imagine that you live a life that's worthy of being a viral brand. I would assume, you know, if you look at some of the biggest brands in the world, I mean, I think they're doing things that are just remarkable or noteworthy or out there. And some people are definitely like putting on a show to do it. I think that's like the traditional sense of brand or like celebrities per se. I think in like the Hollywood setting, it's definitely more like you're almost facilitating activities to be brand worthy. But I think in the business element,
what's brand worthy though? Like, you know, talk about brand worthy. What do you mean when you say that?
Brand worthy? I mean, I think it's just living a life that other people desire to have, or that is inspiring in some way, or interesting, right? I don't think it's necessarily always, but I think probably if we're talking about this space,
you gotta be bringing some value, right? Yeah.
Yeah, you're bringing value because in some way, shape, or form, people like something about the brand, whether if it's entertainment or education, is probably one of the two.
Yeah, worthy of someone's time for sure. Just for the folks out there, you may or may not be readers, but anything that you've read in the last year that added value to your life that you want to share with the folks?
Sure. Unless that was a Layla question, in which case.
This is what we were talking about in the beginning, guys. You got to pull the trigger. All right. Someone's got to be able to jump in and take this one here.
Sure. All right.
I think the best book I read in the last year was probably The Laws of Human Nature. I think that was a really good book. But most people, I don't think finish it because I think it's 1,000 pages or something.
That's a long one. And in Audible, really that's a couple good. Days.
It's yeah. Fantastically written.
Yeah. So I just wrote, so over the last 5 years, I've probably read, bought 50 books a year. I skim most of them. I don't read all of them. And I study a select few that are worth reading. And so my list in no order, most of these are around persuasion because that's the stuff that I find interesting. But influence, persuasion, yes, which is all three of those are by Robert Cialdini.
You know, awesome boy books. Right there. Yeah.
Expert Secrets, I think is really phenomenal for storytelling within the context of breaking beliefs in yourself and others. One to Many is more on the tactics of one to many selling by Jason Fladley. And really, really good book. Very tactical. Ready, Fire, Aim is 0 to 100 million, which for me broke the limit of why we were stuck at 30 million for three, we were between 30 and 40 million a year for 3 years. And so that book broke that for me. How to Make Friends and Influence People was the first book that changed my life. John Wooden on Leadership was a phenomenal book. And a pairing of that book would be The Motive by Patrick Lencioni. That book changed my life from an operational perspective. That's what taught me what operations really meant within a company. And I think that was one of the keystone book, cornerstone books that changed my life. And then, reading everything that Warren Buffett or Charlie Munger have ever produced.
That's a complete list there. So let's hear about you guys a little bit. Where can folks find out more about you? The website, the podcast, give us a little juice here.
All right. So I have a book that you can get on Amazon Kindle for 99 cents called $100 Million Offers. And it outlines what one of the things that we do with most of the companies that we take on that you can usually, a lot of times you can 2X, 5X, 10X your business simply by repositioning and repackaging the stuff that you are selling. So it's how do you provide the most value to the prospect? How do you overcome their obstacles by the nature of how you design your product? How do you weave in scarcity, urgency, guarantees, bonuses into something that becomes incredibly valuable to your target audience? And how to pick that audience so that you can maximize your skill set to the highest degree. And what that translates into in marketing words is you get more clicks for less price. You get more people to say yes, and you get them to say yes at higher prices. And so when you combine more cheap leads, higher percentage converted at higher prices, you make a lot more money. And that is what the $100 Million Offers book is all about. I have a podcast called The Game, which some people like. It's about business stuff. and so those are probably, and then obviously we're on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, we're on all the stuffs.
All right. Gino, he's out there. Let's take it home.
Broke at 26, sleeping on a gym floor for 9 months. Had his wife, Layla, leave him at the time, but she stuck it through. Big props to her because most people out there don't look at the long term. She didn't see, she saw the opportunity and she saw the fire in him. And it wasn't just small. She saw the vision that he had. And by the age of 31, he's at over $100 million. And I really, the book is amazing. And I really want to go over these five epiphanies that he had of why he was broke. I wrote them down. I think everyone should go back and really listen to it. If you're struggling in partnerships, the first one, he had bad partnerships and he and Layla actually said it was their fault, which is great because they're responsibility junkies. The next one, they had no focus. The third, number three, the business model made no common sense. And that's great when you can step back and say this business model sucks. The fourth one is opportunity vehicles. They had low leverage. So we talk about leverage all the time. It's leverage of capital. It's leverage of people as well. And I think the fifth one is providing the most value that you possibly can. He's the ultimate go-giver, everybody. He's out there not just thinking about himself, but giving value. And I think once you give that value, it also adds impact in your life. And you're out there trying to make impact for others. And ironically enough, when you become financially free, you start making a ton of money and you're able to give back to others, that money keeps flowing back to you because you're not chasing money. You're chasing opportunity at this point. And life becomes a lot of fun. You're just playing on house money right now. And at 31 years old, to be able to have that epiphany to do that, man, hats off and kudos to you guys, because that is just a freaking awesome life. So congratulations to all your success.
We appreciate it. Congratulations. 2000 apartment units is nothing to scoff at. I have a question back for you guys. If I'm allowed to ask at this point.
It's your show. Take over.
So when you see Grant, right, and he does multifamily, and so you see what he's done.
Who's Grant?
Grant Cardone.
I'm fucking with you. I know.
Okay. Yeah. I was like, maybe they don't know.
No.
When you combine the brand, right, with the vehicle that you guys have with the fund vehicle and multifamily, you know, give me your breakdown in light of the conversation that we just had of that. And do you see that as something that you guys would want to do? Or like, how do you see yourself?
No, really, really interesting question, because the main difference between what we do and what Grant does is we just buy our deals internally. Like, it's a joint venture between Gino and I. We've done syndications. They're great. We just don't love them as much. We really just kind of like the cash flow snowball that builds up. We use cost segregation. We refi. We're vertically integrated. So we have in-house management. We do all the HVAC, all the flooring and all that shit. So it's a different model where we're not going out. Where we have one syndication on the books right now, and that's it. And everything else is just owned internally. So it's a bit different. But what he's done is absolutely fucking phenomenal, because he took brand, levered that, and then raised a shit ton of money and was able to go out and, you know, buy some A-class assets. You know, I think you guys touched on core values before. We so love the cash flow. We love deals that we can feel really sound on that. You know, I don't know internally what Grant's deals do, but we're typically like, you know, the heavy value add will go in, clean the property up really well, versus he's buying more A-class with skinnier margins. And it just scares me a little bit. I don't necessarily have the appetite for those. I'm sure he's doing great with it. It's not talking shit by any means, but I think it's absolutely phenomenal what he's done, because he's took brand, he's took a fucking great business and merged the two of them. And he's blown up Cardone Capital, where for us to lever brand, there's, in terms of the actual real estate side, it would have to be more on our property management business. And ultimately what we're trying to do there, our blue ocean, is to create a Chick-fil-A of apartments. If you go to Chick-fil-A, you know, I'm in Tennessee, you see lines out the fucking door, you know, waiting to get in. So ultimately we see a disconnect in the value that people are getting in the apartment space, much like a McDonald's. Why isn't there cars out the street? Because they're not getting that high level of service. So we're trying to thread the needle there and create brand on the management side, you know, to really pull that through. That's really it's just a little bit of a different model.
I love that. That's a great vision.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, we've been able to refi over $25 million from our portfolio, me, Jake, and another partner, and just repurpose it. And it's our money. And we read the book Small Giants about a year ago, and that was our vision. I've got six kids, so I want my kids to be in the business. I want it to be a family business. I want them to be involved. That's why I have the education company. And for us, being vertically integrated, we control all processes. We have property managed, we buy, we educate our students on it. And for us, just to be able to get 1,000 units a year, 700, that's what our goal is. And I think if people aren't clear on what they want, you know, and Grant Cardone wants to do a Grant Cardone, that's great. He's got clarity on that. We finally came to that epiphany about a year ago. We're like, we don't have to go syndicate deals. We're doing great with what we're doing, and we're growing our brand, and we enjoy what we're doing, and we're creating impact. Our students have closed over 50,000 units. Our students have done $4 billion in deals.
Awesome.
Yeah, over 60 students have left their jobs in the last 3 years alone. So that's where, for me, like you said, I want to be the ultimate go-giver. I want to help these students, because ultimately students are going to bring us deals. They just talk well about us. We have our event. We have an event in November on the 5th and 6th in Orlando. There's going to be 1,000 real estate investors at that event. So that's what we want to do. And for me, I mean, like you said, it's great. Money's great, but that's not what the ultimate drive is. 10 years ago it was, when I didn't have any, but now it's like, shit, I got more than enough coming in a month, and I don't need to make more. I just want to have fun. Like you said, that time and money really hits home as you get a little bit older, and you're like, man, I don't have that much time left here. Let me make as much impact, and let me show my kids what a dad, what a father is supposed to be, and how we're supposed to impact the world. So that's what we're about.
Tell you this though, that you do get some FOMO when you see Grant fucking taken down like 400 or 500 in a swath here, and you're like, fuck, shit, am I doing the right thing? But I think we're being honest and true to our core, and we love the model that we're doing. And you know, we've done syndications in the past, not necessarily where we are right now, but you never know what the future holds, right? We may expend all our capital here as things loosen up a little bit, and we may be saying, hey, shit, we got to go out and raise some money now if we want to continue to grow. So,
guys, I want to thank you guys for being on. I mean, you guys are
super. Oh, we're still on the show too. And, so, man, we're just kind of.
Yes.
This will go out there. Yes.
Let me just finish by saying, Onyx, it's been an honor and a privilege. You guys are just killing it. I mean, I look up to you guys. I've been watching your stuff. Honestly, it's such a young age to be able to do the stuff that you're doing, and you haven't even started yet. So, once again, thanks a lot.
How old are you guys now?
Really appreciate it.
32 and 29.
That's awesome.
Fantastic. No, that's great.
We appreciate you guys. Thank you so much for having us. It's an honor to the audience. Thank you for guys for giving us your attention. We know you have many places to fly. So thanks for giving us a few.
Thanks, guys.
Take care. See you guys.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career, so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.